My name is Warren Zola, and I'm the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. Welcome to our podcast of the May 3rd Forum featuring Robin Hayes, CEO of JetBlue. As one of the top CEO speaking forums in the world, the Boston College Chief Executives Club gathers Boston's top business leaders several times each year. For this event, Wick Grosbeck, Managing Partner and Governor of the Boston Celtics, engaged in a fireside chat with Robin Hayes, CEO of JetBlue. The conversation focused on JetBlue's transatlantic growth, the pending acquisition of Spirit Airlines, their efforts towards sustainability and carbon neutrality, the need for air traffic control reform, and the importance of culture.
I'm here to say thank you and congratulations to Robin for several reasons. Robin, since you came in 2015 as CEO and president and head of JetBlue, I did the math, and I was a history major, but I can do simple math, and this was pretty simple. Looking at the ratings of customer satisfaction over your tenure as CEO, I've got JetBlue comfortably at the lead of all airlines that you have over year in and year out, whether you're number one or occasionally number two, number one, JetBlue is where it's at. You have brought really top quality service, clean airplanes, great crew and staff, and a really all around elevated flying experience to Boston, and you focused on Boston. So I just want to say thank you to Robin and JetBlue.
Thank you.
I also want to thank you for being a partner of the Celtics. One of your first official acts, as near as I can tell, was to approve our partnership, which is now going on its ninth year. And it is off the court in the community doing STEM labs and computer donations, which is meaningful to you and to us. We love doing that together. On the court, you'll see us, the JetBlue. We have the JetBlue flight crew, which is some games, unfortunately, the most talented and exciting basketball that's played. It's got a JetBlue logo on it, not a Celtics logo, but it's got Celtics as well. But and then especially Lucky Blue, the Celtics livery A320, a beautiful plane. I have some friend or another texting me a picture of that literally every week.
Yeah.
You know, is the team in Florida? They all think, by the way, the team flies on Lucky Blue, but it's a beautiful Celtics. And I think this is what I really want to highlight for everybody here, to get to know Robin a little better. I've gotten to know him a bit, and I'm really glad to. But here's something about Robin, about JetBlue. Not only do they outfit the plane in Celtics livery, and they have a Bruins one and a Red Sox one as well, so they are all in on Boston. They have four teams, and three of them are Boston teams. So they care about Boston. But what are they doing with Lucky Blue this weekend? They're flying it to Philadelphia. And if we advance, they'll fly it to the next city. They take our plane, or their plane, but our colors and our Boston identity, and they fly it to the enemy city, because that's a Red Auerbach quality move. So I just have to say, there's a lot of simpatico. You're okay, born in the UK, University of Bath. Is it Bath or Bath? Bath?
You can say either.
Okay.
Bath.
Yeah. Bath. Yeah. But you came over here, and we feel in Boston that you love us here, and we appreciate it. So I do have a few topics that I'd love to get into, have you get into for the group, and then we'll leave some time at the end for questions. Let's not have the dreaded multi-part question. Can we just ask a question and then get an answer, please, everybody? Thank you. You're all CEOs. You know about the multi-part questions. So, Robin, how have you achieved this, you know, top rating as an airline, well-respected airline, the attention to detail? Amelia and I just flew out, actually filming the sitcom, we flew out from New York to LA and back on Mint. When we do fly to Florida, we fly on JetBlue every single time, and we look forward to it. So you've done this, you've given a really good, great experience, which we personally endorse and enjoy, and you've done it on a budget, essentially. You've done it, and this is something I have no idea. If you look at my basketball team, I have no idea how to have any cost control. You have, in fact, been striking a balance, or working to strike a balance between low fares, affordability, efficiency, and still quality. What's the secret?
No, thanks, Wick, and good afternoon, everyone, and thanks so much for coming in. Thanks for all your support as well. There were so many friends in the room, and I, you know, if this was the New York luncheon, I think half the people would have left already. This is, we've always been so welcome here, and we love being part of the community. We have some of my JetBlue team over there who really make the magic happen. And, you know, I think before I answer that question, the truth of why we decided to focus on Boston when we started growing it about 15 years ago was really little to do with the airline business and more to do with the fact when I lived here in the late 80s, I adopted all the Boston teams. Like, I found a way to get into Fenway Park without paying. That's all my Red Sox friends at the back. I used to work the evening shift try and go and see a game. So, of course, when I became CEO, like, we got to get, like, deals with all these teams. So we had to then build a whole network strategy to support it. So teams first, airline second. I think the good thing in Boston is everyone supports the same team, right? There's one hockey team, one basketball team, one baseball team, one football team. Not the same in New York. You know, they fight over football, they fight over baseball, they fight over basketball, and they sort of fight over hockey. I think for JetBlue, we were founded by a guy called David Neeleman, who created JetBlue. Actually, first flight was in the year 2000. And David really wanted to build an airline that differentiated itself on customer service. And the culture of the organization is very important in making people feel excited and different. Because you made a very important point. I mean, one of the challenges that we have in the US is that you have four large airlines, you know, Delta, American, United, Southwest. There are $40 billion companies or so. And then, you know, you have an airline like JetBlue that's 10. So we're about a quarter of the size. We don't have the same resources as these much larger airlines, so we have to make it count. So we try to focus on creating a product that most people like. You know, we talk about focusing on people's practical needs rather than psychological needs. So, you know, legroom over lounges, I suppose. We just try and, you know, do that. And we try and, as people come into work for JetBlue on the first day, we go and meet them, and we try to just instill in them the importance of just, you know, serving and taking care of our customers. Because we, you know, if you, and to take a financial analogy that you're seeing today with all the big banks, right? The big banks are too big to fail, right? The large airlines are too big to fail. We're not. We're a much smaller airline, and so we have to, you know, we have to deliver well every day.
So can I pick up on that exact point then? Yeah. It's been well reported that for a year or so, you've been pursuing a merger, mm-hmm. an acquisition of Spirit. Mm-hmm. And my understanding from you is that there are four airlines who are, you know, behemoths, or yeah. however you pronounce that, and yeah. then there are the, you know, the up-and-coming JetBlue and Spirit. Can we run the numbers on that? And what's, frankly, yeah. as we would say in Boston, what's the yeah. problem?
I don't know. I don't think there should be one, but the government thinks there is. Every merger in the airline industry has been permitted and allowed until it came to us. One of the reasons that we want to buy Spirit, and you know, the plan would be to turn Spirit into JetBlue, so they have the same airplanes as us, same engines as us. It would allow us to be bigger and bring JetBlue to more markets, right? So we're big in Boston, we're big in New York, we got a reasonable presence in Florida, but you go to the rest of the country and JetBlue, really, people don't really know who we are. And so we have such an opportunity to bring that JetBlue experience to more customers. And we think, actually, that's a game changer. It's a game changer in product quality. I mean, the only reason one of our competitors is offering free Wi-Fi is because we started putting it on airplanes 9-10 years ago. And I know it doesn't always work. They are challenging pieces of kit. The reason that any airline has a free TV in the back of the seat is because we did it 20 years ago. And also the fares. I mean, when JetBlue comes on the market and competes against a legacy airline, right. fares come down on average 20%.
No, as a customer, you would think you'd want, I mean, yeah. I'm completely on board with that. Yeah. You would want to see, first of all, being here, we'd rather have more direct flights and more places to yeah. connect to on you. But if you're out there in Kansas City or Dallas or yeah. wherever you might be, to see JetBlue, things, it's going to be more affordable. So what's the regulatory issue?
So the regulatory issue is that the government is arguing that taking away Spirit is taking away another airline, an airline that offers low fares, and they don't want to see that happening. I think there is a lot of buyer's remorse at the Department of Justice. I think they regret allowing a lot of these deals to have happened over the years. No. But you can't unring that bell. I mean, you've got four airlines with 20%, and you have the rest of us, so JetBlue, Spirit, Frontier, Alaska, Hawaiian, you name that list, with 20% between us. There's such a bifurcation in the industry, and I just don't think, and you know, so we feel good about our case. We would not have spent all this money and put all this work in if we didn't feel we had a really, really good chance of being successful. So we'll see.
So what is the state of the airline industry today? When we talked virtually, it was Warren interviewed you, but I was able to tell a few jokes at the beginning, which was, I only know two jokes, so that was, but we did talk in 2020, really September 2020, so it was a different time. I was down in the NBA bubble, as a matter of fact. Yeah. We were in the playoffs then too, but anyway, what's the state of the airline industry today? It seems busy, it seems like it's on an upswing, but and then where's it going? Because you've got concerns, no doubt, about sustainability and fuel costs and whatever else you've got. So where are we as an industry now, and where do you expect to be in five or 10 years?
No, it's a great question. I mean, I remember sitting in a restaurant in London with the CEO of Airbus in late February 2020. And we were there because we were, you know, if you remember, we were, or you might, there was a fight going on with the EU and the US at that point in time on tariffs, and Airbus airplanes were being impacted by that, and we were trying to work through that. And just over coffee, I mentioned to him, hey, Guillaume, you know, seen any, this thing called COVID that I'm hearing about in China, are you seeing any impact yet? A little bit from our Chinese customers. You know, 3 weeks later, we're in the White House as an industry asking to see if we can get some financial aid for the industry. So it was incredible. You know, we were going over A4A, which is the U.S. Airline Trade Association. We, all the CEOs, we meet every quarter, and we got a meeting with Mike Pence at the White House. And we're, you know, going over in the black SUVs, as you have to if you're going to go to the White House, right? Because all the movies, everyone's in black SUVs, so we got black SUVs. And we're going over there, and on the way over, we're like, oh, the president's going to join the meeting. And we weren't sure if that was a good or bad thing, you know, obviously. Anyway, we went there, and he was very engaged, and he was very supportive. And the airline industry was the only industry that got specific help through COVID. Yeah. And I give a lot of credit of that to actually Doug Parker, who was the CEO of American at the time, because Doug had been at US Airways, or America West, and then US Airways. He'd been there through 9/11. And he could see what was going to happen if the industry did not get help. So we rallied, we got great bipartisan support across the aisle, and that's, you know, that really allowed us to continue. We had to keep everyone in jobs, which we were happy to do. And then, you know, we thought that was the worst year. But what was actually harder was the ramp back up. Because once we got to early 2022, more people were ready to fly than we could deal with. And we stumbled. I mean, this is the anniversary of when I had to come up to Boston and give some media interviews apologizing for our challenges. And if any of you were caught in that, I really apologize. Other airlines went through the same thing last year at different times. We all went through it. And we had to do a reset because we realized that things were never going to be the same in a post-COVID world. You know, you've got higher attrition. There are significant, every one of our airplanes is 6 to 7 months late. When we have to repair things, it's taking 2 to 3 times longer to get them repaired than they normally do. And these things continue to challenge us and other industries. And so, I mean, I'll give you an example. For JetBlue to fly the same amount of capacity as we did in 2019, which is the last normal year in our industry, we have to be about, we have to have about 7% more people to fly the same amount of capacity. So anyway, the good news is, as we come into 2023, so we were all stumbling last year, but then we learned from that, and we kind of hired up, we recruited, we slowed down growth, and you know, for 2023, actually, the industry is in good shape. And we've never had more pilots. We've never had more in-flight crew members. We've never had more maintenance technicians. So we are overstaffed, but we need to be overstaffed. The big challenge this year is actually the air traffic control situation. In the air traffic controllers nationally, they're about 81% of what we need. And in New York specifically, they are at 54%. And so what that is going to... So the FAA approached all airlines about 6 weeks ago, I think it was about 6 weeks, to say, we recommend you pull down 10% of your flying in and out of New York this summer. Otherwise, delays will double over what they were.
So they're saying have the same infrastructure spend, the same crews. You're not going to, you've never furloughed anybody, I don't believe, at JetBlue.
Yeah, we've never furloughed.
So you're going to have the same workforce and same everything else, you just have less revenue coming in.
Yeah, so we have, we've got more cost flying the same people, but but the air traffic controller situation is very challenging. Right. And what that will mean, unfortunately, is just more delays because when the situation gets saturated and there's lots of airplanes flying around and there are insufficient controllers, they slow the system down to keep it safe. Yep. And so, you know, we are working through that issue, but it's going to take a number of years to resolve because it takes 3 to 4 years to fully train African air traffic controllers and get them into the more complex centers.
Where's the tech side of, I mean, I remember all the way back to PATCO, was that like 1980 or something, but 43 years ago, but where's the tech side of ATC right now? What's the infrastructure? Is it, has it been updated? Or is it, I mean, it's supposed to be more efficient. Is it getting there?
It's
scale of 1 to 10?
Well, we've gone from being closer to 1 to being, you know, maybe closer to 5. But we're still a long way to go.
It's not very comforting.
No. Well, I don't want anyone to worry about safe. It is safe. But the fact that the US is still passing off paper strips to controllers who are controlling airplanes when the rest of the world is doing that digitally, and the FAA have said they're going to now have to keep the paper strips for longer because the technical program, the tech upgrades have slowed down. So the technology is one thing, and then I would say the staffing is actually the bigger issue, because I think that is what's going to have the biggest impact on people's flying.
Not sure paper strips even qualifies as tech.
No. Well, they're printed out, you know. They're not handwritten anymore.
There's a printer. There's a dot matrix printer involved. What's your IT? I mean, I'm just, it's a random question, but your IT budget and your staffing at JetBlue, out of how many of your total employees are IT? Because, I mean, the app, the website, the tracking, the baggage, you know, a plane's late, I mean, the gate changes, everything has to change. How do you run an airline from an operations point of view? How do you get that done?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting because the challenges Southwest had over the Christmas holidays, which were well publicized. I mean, you know, I think there's been a lot of focus since then on all of us saying, well, hang on, could that happen to us? And so, you know, we spend a lot on IT. I mean, we have, you know, between our own crew members and we do a lot of outsource. I mean, we've probably got 1,000 people or so involved in IT related work. And, you know, without kind of pitching the Spirit deal again, you know, one of the arguments that I make to the government is like, it takes Delta and JetBlue, it costs us the same to run a website. Yep. It costs us the same to run the operating, but their revenues are 4 times ours. And so we can either be less profitable and do it at the same time, or we have to take it more slowly. And so I think that's another issue as the airlines, that there's more scrutiny now, as there should be, on making sure our tech stack is at the highest quality, is going to require investment. But again, in January, you may remember that morning when the whole US system was grounded for the first time since 9/11, that was an FAA system. And that was the system that gives the pilots warnings about what might be different about the airport that you're flying to. So we can upgrade, but if we're still dealing with, you know, external systems that are 20, 30, or, you know, sometimes older, you know, the risk is still there. By the way, what's interesting about that ground, that when the FAA did that, they didn't actually have to do that because some airlines had backup procedures. So we were operating. Delta was operating, Alaska. There were some airlines that had backup procedures to deal with that eventuality, and there's other airlines that didn't, and they couldn't operate in that period. So we actually were like, we're happy to keep flying, you know. But once the government says you can't fly, you can't fly, clearly.
Yes, they didn't want to embarrass the other ones, but that seems a little bit.
Yeah, I'm sure that was going on in the background.
Mm-hmm. So where will it be in 10 years or 15 years? I mean, I read about electric planes. I read about the exact opposite, which is supersonic.
Yeah.
Or are we going to be going combustion, you know, or what?
Yeah, so there's a big, you know, the big focus in our industry, right, you know, clearly is on sustainability, and I'm proud of JetBlue's record in this. I mean, I do think we are one of the leaders in things like sustainable aviation fuel. The challenge we have is that sustainable, so the US airlines have a goal of being using 10% of their fuel from sustainable sources by 2030. And we are all very active in that. We're working, you know, we compete clearly, but we also partner on a lot of this stuff. And the problem is there's just not enough of it. You know, a lot of this fuel is getting made from, you know, fatty oils and food waste and things like that. And it's just so hard to scale. Again, as I've said to the Department of Transportation, if we can fix ATC and get that more efficient, there's 8 to 9% less emissions we can have right there. And arguably that's easier to get. So we should do both. And then there's, you know, some interesting technologies that may start to have an impact in the next decade, you know, things like synthetic fuels, power to liquid type technology, which kind of takes carbon, captures carbon out in the atmosphere, combines it with clean, what they call green hydrogen, and makes fuel. And then longer term, you know, Airbus are doing a lot of work on hydrogen airplanes. But again, I think that's 15, 20, 25 years away, and there's still a lot of questions about whether, you know, that will be viable. Electric airplanes certainly have a role for smaller airplanes. So, you know, we are Dan Wolf and Cape Air, great friends of JetBlue. They are great partners. And, you know, for something like the airplanes that Cape Air operate, then, you know, electric airplanes absolutely have a place. Mm-hmm.
So you've made it very clear with not just word but deed that Boston's very important to you. And I've heard you remark that Massport has been a big part of that.
Yes.
And there's a special partnership there, and we have the executive director of Massport right here. But even if he weren't here, I know you'd give the same answer. So would you please expound on what he could do better, but no, what they have done well at Massport, because you make a point of saying it, and I think lots of folks know that Massport's there, but we don't have necessarily the insight that you can give us.
Yeah. No, well, we've got Ed, Lisa, and other members of their team here, and just a big shout out. I mean, I have to be nice to them anyway, because they're the landlord, but I actually, they've earned it too, so that's a bonus. But, you know, look, the relationship between airlines and airports is a bit of a love-hate relationship, and so we both do things to immensely annoy each other. But I think what has defined the JetBlue-Massport relationship over the years is just that spirit of partnership and working through some of those things together and coming up with solutions that work for both of us. You know, airports have to play very fair, right? Airlines always want the airport to give them the best stuff, and the airports are very conscious about making sure that it's really of a community benefit. But whether, you know, they've done an amazing job supporting our growth here from like, you know, 10, 20 flights a day to 150, supporting, I mean, and they've done a terrific job. I used to work in Terminal C. I mean, I remember that terminal from the late 80s and modernizing that, and that's the investment in the roadways and the most innovative parking system in the world. Your cars are every single piece of grass and every single hill, and they know exactly who car that belongs to and where it needs to get back to. It's incredible. So, and it's challenging because it's a very small piece of land. It's surrounded by water, and you know, it's tough to operate in those environments. So I just want everyone in the room to know, because, and we work with pretty much every airport in the country, this is an amazing team that you have, and they run a really fantastic airport.
Okay. Duly noted. I saw them taking notes. So how did you make the decision to go compete and open up? I mean, lots of us probably think of Fort Lauderdale, Orlando, JFK, Boston, but you're going to Amsterdam, London, and Paris, not in that order necessarily, London, Paris, and Amsterdam.
Yeah.
How do you as CEO make that decision? What went into that? And then how, and some of those flights are going to be from Boston, so we're excited, but it's a departure, no pun intended, or maybe, pun intended. But
yeah, I mean, if you take those markets, if you look at, let's just take Boston, I mean, if you look at the largest markets that we don't fly to out of Boston, then, you know, London was the one. And we just didn't have an airplane that could do it for the first 20 years of our history. And so we took delivery a couple of years ago of the long range version of the 321 that gave us the juice, if you like, to get to London. And this is where COVID was an opportunity. You know, we would not have three flights a day in Heathrow if it was not for COVID. It, you know, just couldn't get in there. Our team was very creative. I said, you know, I want to get into Heathrow and I don't want to pay for the slots because as a low-cost carrier, we start paying 80 million for slots. It, you know, drives up the fares. Team did a great job, so we ended up with Heathrow and Gatwick from both Boston and New York. Paris actually was then the second largest market, and so we're starting that this summer in New York. Paris from Boston will be next year. And then, you know, Amsterdam is actually very hard to get into, and the airport over there, the government, has said they want to reduce slots because reduce the amount of flying. A lot of concern around the environmental issues of these flights. And so, and the problem, you know, if you think about the business model of Schiphol, for those of you who've flown through it, I mean, the Netherlands is about 16 million people. And whilst it's probably the most densely populated country in the world, if not one of the most densely populated, you know, it's an airport far bigger than the Dutch need because they're taking everyone from the UK and flying them through. And I think in the end, they're like, why are we, you know, emitting all this carbon for people that aren't even flying out in the Netherlands from the Netherlands? So, so anyway, we the industry and others took the government to court. We got an initial victory. And you know, not that the efforts will stop. I'm sure that will be a fight. But we felt as JetBlue that if we didn't get into Amsterdam now, we would never get in, given this sort of pressure on slots over time. So we fought I mean, I know fans, it feels like we sue a lot of people and get sued a lot. So we filed a formal complaint against the Dutch government, which was, and you know, we ended up getting, it worked, because we ended up getting two slots, one for Boston and one for New York. Now, they're not permanent slots, so we're going to have to do what we did at Heathrow, get in there, and once we're in, hope we can stay in there. So, and, you know, I will, and just, I go back to the competition comment. If you drive north of Philadelphia, so leave Philadelphia Airport, and then you drive north up through every airport on the coast to the Canadian border, there's only one flight a day. So, you know, think Newark, think JFK, think Boston. There's only one flight a day to Amsterdam that isn't part of the Delta KLM immunized high fare joint venture.
That's actually, if you look it up, if you look up the legal documents, yeah, that's the name.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a United flight out of Newark. So, you know, so here we are with these like joint ventures that have all of this power, really block competition, and then we can't buy Spirit to become a 9% player. So, you know, all of these things I think just demonstrate how it's been more about protecting the large airlines and helping the small airlines. But anyway, it doesn't matter. We're not deterred. We're in, and you know, we're never going to be off of the frequency that some of these airlines have. But for most people, one or two JetBlue flights a day is fine.
This is the spirit we need on our team tonight. Go forward confidently, make it work, make things.
Well, I'm available tonight if you need us.
I've got your number.
Yeah.
So that'll be fine. Thank you for that. You can be in the flight crew.
You
hold the ball up, Lucky will hold it and dunk, and then you do the reverse.
I thought I could do more, you know, work in the bar.
Well, guess what you'd be serving?
Yeah. And I, you know, providing you paid me and, well, you know, I could drink while I work, I'd be fine.
No problem. So, well, thank you for this. A closing thought, if I've overlooked anything, or we can go straight to questions, but do you have, you
want
to go straight to questions? Yeah. We've got the one-part questions, please. Anybody?
Did everybody hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't need a microphone, so thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi, welcome to Boston. What's your take on the new Breeze airline that was founded by the founder of JetBlue?
Oh, yeah. I think it's a really cool idea. So, you know, so much, all of us at JetBlue have so much admiration for David Neeleman and what he created, and he's a very special guy. And you know, his business model for Breeze is to really fly to you know, smaller to medium-sized cities, to other small to medium-sized cities direct. I mean, we were talking you know, earlier about how you get from Nashville to, was it
Burlington, Vermont? Yeah.
And you know, that's impossible to do directly. So you know, what his idea is you identify those opportunities where people are flying between two cities and, you know, add a flight. Because for a bigger airline, they're never going to be able to make those markets work. But they might. And so I think it's gonna do well. And he's a brilliant brilliant visionary. None of us can keep up with him. I mean, he's founded Jet. He worked at Moyes Air, WestJet, then JetBlue, Azul in Brazil, TAP, and now back at Breeze. I mean, crazy.
Yes, over.
Well, you put the pressure on not asking multi-part questions, so I had to make a choice between asking about inflationary pressure that's hitting all airlines, or what's your favorite, or what's your favorite candy? I think it should be Skybar, Boston's own.
Yeah. Well, my favorite candy is actually, it's an English candy called Fruit Pastels, so you probably never heard of it, but I can actually get them in my local Stop and Shop now, which is pretty good. I don't know how they ended up there, but you can get them. And inflationary pressures, this has been it's an issue for everybody. The fuel has been the biggest increase. I mean, until recently, when we started seeing some relief on the fuel price, the cost of fuel was 40% higher than in 2019 for us, and it's the biggest cost line that we have. I mean, we'll probably spend about $3 billion on fuel this year. So it's a big line item.
I might jump in with a quick one, which is you've been in, I guess, 15, going on 16 years as CEO, and before that worked, and then at JetBlue, and before that at British Airways. Let's say you go another 15 or 20 years, but what will we find you doing?
15 days, if I'm lucky.
All right. What will we find you doing in that next stage of your life, for your fun or enjoyment, do you think about when you look ahead?
Well, I think right now, like the next year or so, is going to be very busy, both on COVID recovery still, and then the Spirit deal.
But in your spare time, if you change to doing less, you're decades from now.
I love traveling. I'd love more time to travel. You know, both my wife and I, we love traveling, and that's the, I'm very privileged in this job. I get to go to places, but it's always for 2 or 3 days,
No wonder where they're going to Paris.
We're doing, but I'd love to better do, I said to my wife the other day, it'd be great if we could just do a month and go from the top of Scotland to the bottom of England and stuff like that. So, that sort of stuff is what I'd like to
do. We're learning more about you and we're liking you every minute. Some more questions? Yes, right there.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of really good people for that because it's not necessarily a great strength of mine. I think we do a few different things in JetBlue. So first of all, on the first day when someone joins us, they meet, the members of the senior leadership team, usually 3 or 4 of a group of 10 or 12. We'll go down and we'll spend like a day and a half with them. So we'll do a quiz night. We'll spend the day with them. We have things called open door policies. So crew members can reach, that's our word for employees, can reach out to anybody about anything. They don't have to go through, a line of chain of command, if you like. We work in the airports, leaders work in airports on holidays. You'll find me and others hosting kiosks and usually screwing things up. But it's well-meaning. We all clean airplanes. So we are very, we take the approach that we're kind of in this together. And then it's the little things, right? Everyone has the same healthcare plan. Everyone has the same sort of 401k type structure. So we try to create a very egalitarian type model. I will say it's been very challenging with COVID because before COVID, we were a company of about 23,000 people. We were hiring probably 2,000 a year. And it's quite easy to assimilate at that amount, and they go into a workplace, and everyone around them is, doing things in a certain way. With COVID, we hired 7,000 people last year, so you would go into an airport, and the most experienced person there would be 3 months in the company. So that sort of continuity of culture was difficult. So I will tell you, we're still building back from that a lot, and it's not where we want it to be. But we're working very hard, and because the labor market has settled down a little bit now, we're able to, we're able to kind of slow down the hiring, be more thoughtful about the hiring, manage the folks out that clearly, aren't doing it the way that we want it to be done. And it's settling down, but it's probably gonna be another year or so before we feel we kind of got it back to 2019. And I think all of us in businesses recognize that challenge that we've sort of been through in the last year and a half. I mean, last year really was about getting people and training them. And now it's about getting the right people and training them.
Yes.
Thank you. Robin, thank you for being here today. And thank you for being so loyal to Boston. We kind of like that here a little bit. If you think about your business and safety being paramount importance, I'm curious what role artificial intelligence plays in innovation in your company, if you think about some of the air traffic control issues. But if you think about in the context of safety in artificial, the onset of AI, what are you thinking?
Yeah, so, you know, the question was really about the role of AI in safety. So we live in a very regulated industry, and, you know, we have to be very careful about change. So we see a lot of opportunity for things like machine learning and AI, and we're using it today in things like, you know, how we price flights, how we revenue manage flights, you know, identifying during weather events what we think we may have to do in terms of canceling and delaying flights. And we've developed so much capability over the last 2 years we didn't have before that. And by the way, we have a subsidiary called JetBlue Ventures that actually, which we created back around 2015, 2016, that invests in a lot of these companies to help us get smarter. In terms of, and I think there's gonna be a lot in the safety world around identifying trends that different airlines are seeing and aggregating them and trying to understand what's driving, you know, what's driving different things. I will say one of the reasons the US airline industry is so safe is that there is a great data sharing program that exists between all airlines and also pilots and others reporting. Like if you're a pilot on JetBlue or any airline and you make a mistake, you really want to feel comfortable reporting that so that we can build up and say, yeah, okay, 38 pilots have all made the same mistake on this approach coming into Boston. So we know we have an issue, we need to fix it. So we've got this great no. And one of the concerns about the Boeing issue, from my point of view, there was a lot of pressure to make that safety role more adversarial. And clearly in oversight, you've got to have some adversarial part to it. But I was worried that some of that sort of open collaboration of data. I mean, I chair a regular safety review board meeting where I manage sort of six times a year. We go through every risk in the company that we've identified. We have the FAA and regulators in that meeting with us seeing the sausage being made. So I think there's gonna be a huge role for it in identifying issues and then hopefully changing things before, you know, something occurs.
Who's got a mic?
Good afternoon, Robin. Thanks for coming to Boston. How much longer do you anticipate that the pilot shortage will persist?
I would say another 2 to 3 years before it starts to get better. You know, I think, first of all, pilot salaries have gone up a lot, and so they're a much more attractive career for people who want to do it. Companies like JetBlue and others, you know, we've got very creative in creating low-cost pathways to become a pilot. You know, one of the problems with pilots was it was a $200,000 to $250,000 training to go through college unless the military was going to train you. And JetBlue's done a lot of cool programs. I mean, for example, one thing that we do, you come and work for JetBlue in any job, including, you know, working in the airport, the sales team, corporate communications team. And you work for us for 2 years and you want to train to be a pilot, we'll train you. And so we're now sort of, we've got people, crew members going through that. You know, I was just emailing earlier today, one of our ex-in-flight crew members, she's now at Cape Air as a pilot on one of our training programs and she'll come back to JetBlue. And so we're not the only, we were the first to do it, but there's others doing it. So a mixture of making it more accessible, and also, you know, just the better pay.
It will seems mean, like a very, that's an innovative thought. That's really.
Yeah, it's been really cool. Because, you know, one of the big challenges with pilots are, you know, diversity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 95% male and very, very white. And, you know, I was one of our competitors, you know, another airline was talking about their targets for diversity. And I think that's always a tricky thing. You know, you want a more diverse work group, clearly, and pilots are not diverse. You've got to do something about that. But you just got to make, but I know our frontline crew members are very diverse. You know, you go to any JetBlue airport and we've got our amazing crew members from all different sorts of cultures. So we just have to create pathways for remove the financial obstacles and put people into those training programs. And then we'll have the most diverse pilots in the country. And, you know, people say, well, if you set diversity targets, isn't that going to reduce the quality? You know, we've all heard that. And I say, no, it's the opposite, because if you create these programs, you're going to have more people apply, and we can actually have better pilots, because we can pick the best. So I'm very proud of everything we're doing. I think by the end of the year, we'll have nearly 1,000 pilots who are either flying or in training through one of our programs that are designed to do that.
Yeah. I think we have time for two more. Mary? Yes.
Thank you for being here in Boston. I want to talk about unruly passengers.
Yeah.
FAA released its report, and the numbers are staggering.
Yeah.
And I think you should add, when you ask people if they are comfortable sitting in an emergency row, if they are comfortable with the exit procedure, if they would be willing to tackle unruly passengers. So do you think that the FAA rules for quickly adding these people to the no-fly list is appropriately? And let me hear your thoughts. And I'm a mint lover about unruly passengers. Thank you.
I would say we definitely saw an uptick during COVID, and I think the masks were a huge part of that. I mean, for the first part, you know, everyone was happy to wear a mask, and then it kind of got political, and so, you know, we had people who were very strident about not wearing masks. We had also people who got very upset if someone, you know, was taking too long to drink something and not put their mask back on, and it was impossible for our in-flight crew members. I mean, how do you referee that, you know? That person's taking 2 minutes longer to drink a Coke than I would, or Pepsi, I should say, as we're Pepsi now. Still make that mistake. I would say it's still an issue, but it has got better. You know, it is getting better. I also think that we are doing things like training our team to look for signs for intoxication. That's a big issue. People getting on an airplane and they're already intoxicated. By the way, that's one of the reasons we just became the first airline to roll out a non-alcoholic beer. We still have alcoholic beer, don't worry. But we have a non-alcoholic option as well. So, you know, that's an option for somebody. So hopefully it's getting better. We certainly, we do have no-fly lists of people who are sort of extremely bad, but it's still a very small percentage of people that fly.
All right, last one. Let's make it a good one, Boston. Who's up for it?
Then I have a question for you, Wick.
Okay.
Yeah.
No comment. I guess it's your turn, Robin. You're up.
I just want my appreciation to come through to all of you here today, not just for coming for the lunch, but just for all the support you give us. I know we're not perfect. We're working to be better every day. We have a great team here. Thanks to all of our great partners here as well, to Massport and all of you. So I have a question for Wick. I asked you earlier, but I'm going to ask you in front of your team. How do I get someone on the Jumbotron tonight at the game? I've got their seat number. I just need them on the Jumbotron.
My crack crew over there, we're going to put you on too, whether you're there or not. I'm going to find out where you are and put you up there as well.
But thanks. You've been a great partner. Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club, featuring Robin Hayes, CEO of JetBlue. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.